This vote will haunt our Republican colleagues for years to come.
This is a president who was a businessman first, and he knows what he is doing.
USA! USA! We've got the hottest country anywhere in the world.
The yeas are 218, the nays are 214. The motion is adopted.
Welcome to World News Weekly. I'm Katrina Stirrett, and joining me is Claudia Farhart. A big week for Trump's so-called Big Beautiful Bill. I must say that alliteration never gets old, Claudia.
Well, it looks like it's here to stay as well, Kat. Mm. The controversial massive tax cut and spending bill has now narrowly passed through Congress on a 218 to 214 vote.
Yeah, in the end, only two Republican senators voted against the bill, but there were certainly a number of sticking points with this one, including how much national deficit it will create and then the concern about how much it will bring cuts to healthcare and social services.
Mm, also a big week for Donald Trump's Nobel Peace Prize ambitions, Kat. He seems keen to add a few more deals to the CV, upping the pressure on Israel to agree to a ceasefire in Gaza. And he's just brokered a peace deal between the DRC and Rwanda after three decades of conflict too. That one happens to come with a side of rare earth minerals for the US.
Nice. We'll be chatting about both those stories this week. We're also taking a look at the broader ramifications of the US's strikes on Iran, a little closer to home in the Pacific. And the Dalai Lama has made a long-awaited announcement on his successor, but Beijing isn't happy about it. We've got one big, beautiful episode coming up.
It's a terrible situation that's going Gaza, he's asking about. And we think within the next week we're going to get a ceasefire.
The ceasefire between Israel and Iran appears to be holding a week after US President Donald Trump announced the two sides had reached a deal to end their 12 days of fighting. You might remember we spoke about this in the pod last week. Mm-hmm. And now the US president is pushing another deal. He says Israel has now agreed to conditions to finalise a 60-day ceasefire with Hamas. Claudia, what do we know about this potential deal?
To be honest, not a whole lot at this stage, Kat. So far, Trump's just said that Israel's agreed to the necessary conditions, not necessarily a deal, just the conditions to finalise it. He says the deal would last 60 days, during which time the US would sort of work with both sides, with Israel and Hamas, to reach a permanent end to the war. He didn't say what the conditions were that Israel had actually agreed to either. Hamas has since come out saying it's studying this proposal, which I guess is promising. But Netanyahu's also come out too and said any peace deal that he's going to sign would have to be one that banishes Hamas for good. He said his country's not going to be living next to, quote, Hamas-stan anytime soon. So this is perhaps maybe not as done a deal as Trump seems to be suggesting, but it is all coming ahead of Trump and Netanyahu's meeting scheduled for next week in Washington, D.C. And the reading on this is it's going to be a bit of a victory lap after their strikes in Iran of the last few weeks. But Trump has also said in the lead up to this that he's going to be very firm with Netanyahu. I mean, we saw his strong language last week on the South lawn of the White House aimed at Israel and at Netanyahu's government. Trump says he's not afraid to be firm and he thinks he's going to have a deal done within a week. So, I mean, it could be part of this strategy we see from Trump often, you know, turning up the pressure before these meetings, trying to force Netanyahu to the table. But it will be interesting to see what comes out of that chat next week.
Yeah, definitely. And there's been so many attempts to reach a ceasefire since the last one that collapsed that haven't led to anything. If there really has been progress on this, why do you think it's come now?
There could be a few things going on here. There could be a sense that Netanyahu kind of owes Trump one after he stepped in on the Iran strikes. I mean, he upended his nuclear talks by starting those strikes. And we know Trump didn't want to be dragged into another war, particularly in the Middle East, right? Yeah. He wants to be the peacemaking president. But also on the timing, I mean, we spoke about the meeting next week, but we've also got Netanyahu's ongoing corruption trial in Israel. This has been going for longer than the war in Gaza that began on October 7, 2023 at least. Last week, we saw something interesting on Truth Social where Trump publicly called for that case, Netanyahu's corruption case, to be thrown out. He called it a ridiculous witch hunt and he said it was the United States of America that saved Israel. He's referring to the strikes on Iran there. Mm. And now it's going to be the United States of America that saves Bibi Netanyahu. But it got a little stronger. He seemed to even condition the US's ongoing support of Israel, military support of Israel, on Netanyahu being pardoned. He wrote on Truth Social, "The United States of America spends billions of dollars a year, far more than on any other nation, protecting and supporting Israel. We are not going to stand for this." So that was widely interpreted as leveraging the US's, you know, billions and billions of dollars of military support for Israel to get this trial cancelled. The Israeli opposition, which is obviously hugely critical of Netanyahu and supportive of this corruption trial, immediately speculated that Trump is trying to get this case thrown out as some sort of reward, right, to get Netanyahu to come to the table and finally agree to a peace deal. And surely enough, this week, the Israeli courts did cancel one of Bibi's hearings. It said it had accepted a request from the Prime Minister on classified diplomatic and security grounds to cancel it. They didn't say what those grounds were, obviously. It's not exactly an explicit link, but we know Trump wants to be the peacemaker here. It could well all fit together.
Yeah, and we also saw some significant reporting out of Israel this week, with IDF soldiers telling the Haaretz newspaper they were ordered to fire on crowds gathering to collect aid. This is off the back of those near-daily shooting incidents we've been talking about on the pod for a few weeks now that have been reported around the US and Israeli-backed Gaza Humanitarian Foundation's food distribution hubs. What did these soldiers tell Haaretz?
So these were unnamed IDF soldiers and officers speaking to Haaretz. And so far, we only know of reports like this being published in the newspaper Haaretz. But they described the areas around these aid distribution sites as a killing field. They said they'd been ordered to fire on crowds as a means of crowd control to disperse Palestinians as they gathered to wait for humanitarian aid, even when they were presenting no apparent danger to the IDF soldiers and forces in the area. One soldier said, "I'm not even aware of a single instance of return fire." The health ministry in Gaza says about 550 people have been killed in these incidents over the past month. Immediately when these reports came out, the Israeli prime minister and the Israeli defense minister both rejected them as false. They called them blood libels. But the IDF says it is now investigating reports of what it called harm to civilians while approaching aid sites. It said on Monday that there's already been lessons learned from those investigations. It didn't say what those lessons were. We do know that the fatal incidents on the ground in Gaza are continuing. One of the most recent was at a seafront cafe that's frequented by journalists and activists because it's one of the last places in the strip that has public internet access. And this week it was struck and at least 30 people were reported dead. So the Committee to Protect Journalists and Reporters Without Borders both say this is evidence of the IDF targeting journalists in Gaza. The IDF obviously denies doing that, but says it is looking into these specific reports about this internet cafe.
And since those reports in Haaretz about IDF soldiers being ordered to fire on Palestinians gathered at aid sites, two US contractors working for the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation have also spoken out, telling the Associated Press their security staff have also been using live ammunition and stun grenades to control hungry crowds. Last week, while the world's attention was undoubtedly on America's stealth bombers homing in on Iran's key nuclear sites, another major power was quietly watching, China. Now, as Beijing ramps up military drills in the Pacific and hosts Tehran and Moscow for high-level defence talks, the strategic signals are getting harder to ignore. So too, the burning question, what could President Trump's show of might and power mean for a potential showdown over Taiwan?
Well, we have just the person to help us unpack all of this. Let's bring in our colleague, Jeff Kwan, who's the executive producer for SBS Chinese. Jeff, thanks so much for coming on the pod.
No, thank you for having me. And please lower your expectations.
Not at all. Well, let's start with the big picture, I guess, Jeff. How is China likely interpreting America's decision to strike Iran's nuclear facilities, do you think?
Interesting, because in the recent NATO summit, and the United States did deliver a message to NATO and Australia as well, say, boost up your defense budget, right? EU will, and Australia might not, but China will definitely boost up their defense budget. Why? Because Trump did this to Iran. Trump showed his muscle, showed United States' muscle to the whole world. Meanwhile, it triggers people's alarm. Oh, you can secretly launch an air strike to us, and you can sneak in my territory without being noticed. And so definitely China will boost up his muscle as well.
Interesting. And do you think President Trump's willingness to act militarily abroad reshapes Beijing's assumptions about US resolve over Taiwan?
Definitely. Mm. Yeah, this is 100% for sure, because Trump is unpredictable.
Mm.
His tariff policy, decision measures disturb all the existing orders. So they would definitely think twice when they make a decision whether they are going to invade Taiwan. Mm. But there is a mainstream voice in mainland China. There eventually will be a war between US and China.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's why the Chinese POA or the Chinese government is always preparing for the conflicts between United States.
Mm, yeah, China also hosted Iran and Russia's defense ministers while the 12-day conflict with Iran and Israel was playing out. Mm. What's your reading on that, Jeff? Do you think it's a coordinated counter message to the West or something more symbolic?
In one way, yes, China, you know, we have a new ally here and people or nations and who you don't like, United States, you're welcome to me. Mm. You're welcome to my side. On the other hand, I think by doing this, China sent a message to the Western. I'm the one who can play with lions and tigers. I am the one can ask them to sit down and listen to me. I am the only one can handle this conflict. So they're playing both hands.
And let's talk about China's recent combat drills in key regional waters, including the Yellow Sea, South China Sea, and so on. State media reported foreign aircraft and warships approached Chinese carriers during these exercises. It's still unclear if Australia was involved. Beijing's Navy calls this far sea confrontation training. What do these confrontations tell you about the level of surveillance and tension in the region right now?
You know, as a Taiwanese, I will say, oh, it's so cliche. It happened in past 70 years already, and it's still happening. Why you practice something or one skill? Why?
To get it right.
Yeah, to get it right, to do it right. Or I would like to utilize it to get something I want, right? So one thing I notice about is that the PLA Navy is now focusing on doing the military drill surrounding Taiwan. Back to 2000, when I did my mandatory service in the army, the one main thing, the Taiwanese defense plan is focused heavily on that, using its mountain range to preserve our air force or our navy. And we need to survive from the first strike. Then we can fight back. But 20 years after, now Chinese have the ability to project its carriers, its jets to our eastern side, which means that, you know, we built a very large air base inside the mountain. Now it's useless. So now this is a game changer. The old plan cannot be applied or cannot be used anymore. So we need to come up a new plan. In this case, I will say, yes, it triggers our alarms that we're in danger. In my opinion, the war will not stop by a military exercise or military drill. This kind of military drill is more like a stage play. You know, I play, you look. You play, I look. And I learned as well. But for Taiwan, the most dangerous situation, I would say, something not predictable. Something happened in the sudden. You have totally no prepare for that. I would say that's the most dangerous situation. Yeah.
Obviously, lots of different players, but very interesting to see how the strikes are having ramifications a bit closer to home. Thank you so much for your insights, Jeff.
Thank you for having me again.
Jeff Kwan, executive producer for SBS Chinese there.
This moment has been long in coming. It will not erase the pain, but it can begin to restore what conflict has robbed many women, men and children of: safety, dignity, and a sense of future.
There is no doubt that the road ahead will not be easy. But with the continued support of the United States and other partners, we believe that a turning point has been reached.
Turning our eyes to Africa, where there is skepticism around the long-term outcome of a US-brokered peace deal between Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. We obviously just heard encouraging messages from foreign ministers of both countries there, but Many citizens and regional experts are cautious of celebrating just yet. The two countries have a long and tense history of conflict, which has resulted in the displacement of 7 million people. And on top of this, it's also important to remember the Trump administration's closure of USAID severely depleted aid resources in the DRC. 500,000 people still considered at risk and struggling to access food and water. So certainly some questions around the United States' motives here as well, which we'll be touching on shortly. Mm. But Claudia, these two neighbours have been in conflict for more than three decades. How likely is this deal to actually create peace?
Well, there have been peace deals in the past that were never implemented and endorsed. So, yeah, there is a lot of scepticism that this one is going to work out any better than the previous ones. For some context about how entrenched, I guess, this conflict is, the fighting really dates back to 1994, to the Rwandan genocide, where a million Hutus fled into what is now the DRC, fearing reprisals in Rwanda. Rwanda has twice invaded the DRC since, saying it's going after those responsible for that genocide. But analysts say this sort of simmering conflict in those three decades has led to approximately 6 million deaths in the eastern DRC ever since. That would make it the deadliest conflict since World War II. But the biggest issue this time around with this deal is that it seems to have left out several key players in the conflict. For example, M23 rebels, who are widely believed to be backed by Rwanda, which Rwanda denies, and who have been at the real core of most of the fighting that we've been seeing over the past few months that's resulted in more civilian deaths and more civilian displacement. So they now control Goma and Bukavu after huge offensives earlier this year with the help of approximately 7,000 Rwandan soldiers, according to security analysts. And this deal, some people believe, could put them in an even stronger position because they're not party to it and they haven't been at the table. They're not going to be liable for what's been signed on here. Many are asking how they could even agree to a peace deal without the M23, given their advance this year has, you know, killed and displaced so many thousands of people. There are separate talks going on in Qatar at the moment between the DRC and the M23 rebels, but after months and months of mediation, there's still been no results there. So there's still a lot of questions. Some people are looking at it as more of a trade deal than a peace deal. But I guess we'll know soon enough if it is going to work out because Trump says it's going to be implemented within 90 days.
Yeah, and the other part of this deal is what's in it for the US, and there are now separate negotiations happening between the American and Congolese governments to give the US access to the DRC's wealth of rare earth minerals. Will that give the US some incentive to enforce the peace deal?
It seems like the reading on this is that the minerals are sort of a blessing and a curse here. They're mostly untapped mineral reserves, and the US estimates that they're worth something in the range of 36 trillion Australian dollars. Yeah. They include like some of the world's highest grade copper deposits, for example. So there's huge incentive for the US to see this through and make this peace deal work, because obviously mining, whether it's by the US or by corporations or by anyone really, is going to rely on security and stability in the region. But the minerals have also been one of the biggest factors in keeping this conflict going. I mean, Rwanda has been long accused of exploiting the eastern DRC's minerals through its alliance with the M23. Rwanda denies that, but the UN has been pointing out for the last couple of years that it believes that the gold smuggled out of the eastern DRC into Rwanda is behind this gold export boom that they've been seeing in Rwanda. So there is a clear link there. In the background to all of this, the US and China are kind of getting into an escalating race for these critical minerals across Africa more broadly. So over the past few years, China has spent billions and billions of dollars setting up mining and critical minerals projects in Africa. They're focusing a lot on cobalt and lithium, which are the minerals you need to sort of power green energy to make electric batteries. Also rare earths needed for defense manufacturing too. And the DRC has become a bit of a focus for Chinese investment in that time. So the US could be trying to play catch up here. And I guess it means that the DRC could become another arena for their bigger hostilities between these two superpowers and the bigger competition between them. At the same time that this peace deal was being hammered out in Washington, Quad leaders were also getting ready to meet, and they've just agreed to collaborate on a critical minerals deal as well. well to counter what they called China's dominance in this area. So there was already the minerals for security deal in Ukraine earlier this year, which we spoke about on the pod a few months ago. It seems like this could be the way these deals are going to get done from now on.
Let's do a quick whip around the world to some other major developments worth marking this week. Ukraine's ability to defend itself is now growing more fragile, with the US announcing a pause in key weapons shipments. Russian attacks on Kherson and Kharkiv came shortly after the decision, heightening fears Moscow will become even more emboldened in its strategy.
Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov saying the fewer weapons that are supplied to Ukraine, the closer the end of the special military operation is. And here is Malcolm Davis, a senior analyst from the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, speaking to the World News team.
Essentially, what happens is if the Ukrainians run out of air defense missiles, then Ukrainian cities are wide open to attack, and you will see the casualty rates in Ukrainian cities dramatically skyrocket as a result. So the danger here, to put it bluntly, is that large numbers of Ukrainians will die as a result of the US decision to cut off the supply of critical defensive missiles going to Ukraine.
Thailand's constitutional court has suspended Prime Minister Paetongtarn Shinawat over a leaked phone call with former Cambodian dictator Hun Sen. In the call, Shinawat referred to Sen as uncle and offered to, quote, take care of anything he wanted.
She was also heard making comments critical of the Thai military, and this was in the wake of Thailand's recent border clash with Cambodia, which stirred public outrage. The court will now consider a petition from 36 senators calling for the Prime Minister's dismissal.
And one of Hong Kong's last major pro-democracy parties has now disbanded, just days ahead of the fifth anniversary of Beijing's national security laws. The League of Social Democrats said they couldn't elaborate on the reasons for or timing of its closure, but they did say it was facing, quote, intense pressure.
That is now the third major opposition party in Hong Kong to disband this year. Pro-democracy protests had been largely halted due to the threat of prosecution since the national security laws came into effect. But the League of Social Democrats were the last group really still staging small demonstrations despite the risks.
There's been a long-awaited announcement from the Himalayas this week, the Dalai Lama saying he will be reincarnated, putting to rest years of speculation. The 600-year-old institution he leads would end with his death. Monks have been gathering in the Indian town of Dharamshala, where the Tibetan Buddhist leader has been living in exile for more than 60 years since Beijing annexed Tibet. They're there for his 90th birthday celebrations, where he delivered a message via video saying nobody except the trust he founded has the authority to name his successor. Claudia, his announcement is sure to anger Beijing, which says it has the authority to name his successor. Talk us through the conflict.
So in Tibetan tradition, lamas are reincarnated after their death. So the current one was identified at the age of two, right? Yeah. So, I mean, given he's turning 90 a long time ago, he's the 14th leader and all but two of them have come from Tibet.
Mm.
But after his death, it will be the first time a successor will have to be chosen since China annexed Tibet back in the 1950s. So there's been a lot of speculation that the post could end with him. I mean, he even said a few years ago that there may not be another one after his death. But he's always insisted if he does have a successor, then that successor must come from outside China, from what he calls the, quote, free world. Mm. Beijing, on the other hand, views him as a Tibetan separatist. So his announcement, will likely infuriate them. And Beijing has already reacted, insisting that, it will be the one to choose his successor and that his successor will come from China.
Yeah, and it wouldn't be the first time China has intervened in the institution. Back in the 90s, when the second highest leader was reincarnated, that's the Panchen Lama. The young child disappeared and was replaced by someone appointed by Beijing.
Mm.
The young boy became known as the world's youngest political prisoner.
Yeah, and still to this day, no one really knows what happened to him. And just before these birthday celebrations kicked off, the Chinese president, Xi Jinping, met with that Beijing-appointed Panchen Lama, and the result was that the Panchen Lama promised to make the religion more Chinese.
Interesting.
He's dismissed as an imposter by many in the faith, right, both within Tibet and those, the many of them living in exile. So his influence is probably somewhat limited there, but a lot of analysts believe China has identified the Dalai Lama's death as another opportunity to further cement its control over Tibet. So if they can extend the control that they already have over the territory to its spiritual leadership too. So what we might see happen here is two Dalai Lamas appointed, one by the current Dalai Lama's trust, as he's laid out in his birthday speech, and one appointed by China as well. I mean, whether anyone in Tibet or around the world would actually recognize a Chinese chosen leader is, I guess, another question, because they certainly didn't with the Panchen Lama.
With Beijing, India, and even the US vying for influence over the choice, the political drama of it all is making me reminiscent of the conclave.
Yeah, we do love a spiritual leader being chosen on this podcast.
We really do.
I'm attempting to become the first person ever to fly to all seven continents solo, but getting here hasn't been easy.
That was Ethan Guo, a 19-year-old pilot and social media star who's been attempting an ambitious record, flying around the world in an effort to raise money for cancer research. But Ethan's journey has hit a bit of, wait for it, turbulence.
Oh, Kat.
I can't help it. Each week, I can't help it. After he was detained in Chilean Antarctica after landing his single-engine Cessna at an airstrip on an island off the coast of Antarctica.
I didn't know you could get arrested in Antarctica. Do they have, like, police there or
that's
something?
That's what I'm trying to visualize. But anyway, that happened. Chilean prosecutors are very unhappy with the US influencer, saying that he made an unscheduled change to his flight plan.
Apparently, he was supposed to take off from Punta Arenas in southern Chile, which he did, and then just fly around the city. But at some point, this 19-year-old decided to take a turn towards Antarctica.
A bit different.
Yeah, a bit of a change of route. Authorities saying he broke multiple national and international regulations in doing so. He's since been flown back to Chile, where he has faced court. His defense is arguing that he was simply scoping out the route and had to land on the island due to complications with his plane.
I like that. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
As you do. Interesting, this isn't the first time he's been in trouble with the law on this journey. According to his Instagram, he was also detained for a night in Myanmar after he was forced to make an emergency landing there due to bad weather.
I don't know how many times you can use that same excuse.
No.
Like when you've been arrested multiple times for like illegally flying into
he's
another.
He's going to run out of that eventually, surely.
Like where will he go next?
And that's the world this week. If you've been enjoying World News Weekly, be sure to like and subscribe. Let us know what parts of the world you'd like us to explore next.
We'll be keen to hear from you all.
Absolutely. See you next time, Claudia.
See you then, Kat.